Welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. This week's show features highlights from a recent Naturalist Night presentation in Carbondale. Dr. Miranda Redmond spoke about her research on pinyon pine and juniper habitat and the effects of a warming climate on this ecosystem.
I'll first be kind of introducing you all to pinyon juniper ecosystems, why they're so amazing, make you fall in love with those ecosystems. I'll kind of briefly touch on some history of these woodlands and the changes they've undergone in the past century. And then I'll discuss some more recent changes to pinyon juniper woodlands and specifically management actions as well as global climate change. So pinyon juniper woodlands are a really spatially extensive vegetation type in the southwestern U.S. and especially in the Four Corner states and in Nevada. And they're dominated by pinyon trees, and there's several different pinyon species, as well as juniper trees, and there's also kind of multiple different juniper species. And in kind of the Four Corner states, the woodlands are really dominated by two-needle pinyon pine, and I'll be talking predominantly about those woodlands, but there are woodlands in Nevada that are dominated by single leaf pinyon, and I'll touch on those a little bit, but most of my research really focuses on two-needle pinyon pine. And one of the really neat things about these woodlands is they, particularly in the kind of Four Corners region, and especially in a lot of Utah, they have these really unique biological soil crusts, and these crusts really stabilize the soil. They add nutrients to the soil. They fix carbon, and they take multiple years to form, and it's made up of various different organisms. And pinyon juniper woodlands also provide an array of ecosystem services. They're commonly grazed by cattle throughout the Southwest. And pinyon produces really prolific cone crops some years, and they have these highly nutritious seeds that are consumed by a wide array of wildlife species. Pine cones are also harvested by commercial pine nut harvesters. So if you're ever in Santa Fe, for example, in the fall, you'll see stands of pinyon seeds being sold. They're also culturally important to a wide array of Native American tribes and harvested each fall, often with kind of associated ceremonies, and then roasted in these kind of open pits. So that's kind of a really brief introduction to pinyon juniper ecosystems and kind of why we should care. Now I want to dive a little bit into kind of the history of these woodlands over the past century. Similar to many forested ecosystems throughout much of the western U.S., there has been documented kind of expansion and thickening of these woodlands throughout many areas, beginning in the early 1900s. And a lot of this kind of expansion and thickening that occurred in the early 1900s was attributed to grazing. So cattle prefer grasses over the kind of unpalatable tree needles. And so by, eating grasses, they were able to reduce grass competition and allow pinyon and juniper trees to establish. And so that's kind of largely been the rationale that then resulted in a lot of historic treatments in pinyon juniper woodlands. And these treatments occurred because of that expansion and thickening that was, thought to be predominantly due to human causes. And that thickening was associated with declines in understory plant cover and thought to have led to increases in soil erosion. And so this led to a lot of management actions in these woodlands. One kind of really common activity that was done, particularly between the 1950s and 70s, was chaining, which is like a 240-foot long chain that was dragged across these woodlands. It weighs about 23,000 pounds and literally dragged across to topple over the trees to reduce tree cover and increase understory plant cover. And these treatments really leave a lot of legacy effects in these woodlands. I did a study with kind of several other people, and you know, we found that areas that have been treated did have less tree cover 40 to 60 years after those treatments. They did have greater grass cover, which was a management goal, although that was predominantly due to crested wheatgrass, which is actually a non-native species that was seeded. And then those areas had less biological soil crust cover, as well as greater bare mineral soil cover, and less pinyon pine recruitment relative to juniper, suggesting that kind of down the road, those areas will be more juniper dominated for the next little while. And I'll get to why that is likely the case further on in this talk. So these kind of management actions have occurred in 247,000 hectares of pinyon juniper woodlands owned by the Bureau of Land Management in the broader Colorado Plateau region. So here is Utah, here's southwestern Colorado, New Mexico, and northern Arizona. And that corresponds to about 6.6% of pinyon juniper woodlands within BLM lands were treated. And as I mentioned, kind of the historic treatment rationale was largely because there's been, you know, this documented evidence of this expansion and that it was thought to be really human caused due to grazing. And what we've been learning is that it's oftentimes due to natural reasons. So for example, in the early 1900s, there was kind of multi-year wet period. And that's when a lot of tree establishment occurred. And so the period when we saw that expansion and infilling, that establishment was occurring during that cool, wet climate period. In addition, there's also been past logging in the 1800s. So in the Great Basin in particular, as you're walking around these woodlands, sometimes you'll come across these pile of dead wood, which is basically trees that were harvested in the kind of mid 1800s to make charcoal for the railroad. And so you might think that an area has gotten denser over the past century, but really it was just recovering from past logging. And so just kind of a couple take-home messages so far. Hopefully you, especially living in Carbondale and you see these woodlands, you have fallen in love, it's Valentine's Day, with pinyon juniper woodlands. And the other kind of point that I wanna make is that, you know, the historical management of these woodlands to reduce pinyon trees, the rationale for it was not really consistent with our current knowledge of all the different drivers that have led to increases in tree densities. And so now I want to kind of dive into recent changes in pinyon juniper ecosystems, both kind of in terms of how management goals have really shifted, as well as talking about climate change effects. The early 2000s was a really dry period that prompted a lot of wildfires in the western U.S. Across many different ecosystem types, including in pinyon juniper woodlands. And this really prompted kind of national policy concerns to reduce the risk of these wildland fires, particularly right at the wildland-urban interface, so you know, next to homes, because they're really economically costly. And another issue with pinyon juniper woodlands and other forested types, you can also get this huge influx of invasive species after, especially cheatgrass, that is a really good competitor in these dryland ecosystems, and also then kind of changes fire behavior and promotes fire spread into the future. So it's a really high management concern, especially because after they establish, it's really hard to get rid of cheatgrass. So current management goals are really to kind of reduce the risk of wildland fire, but then also, you know, increase native understory plant species cover and, you know, not lead to increases in non-native species, and also reduce soil erosion rates. Generally, they intentionally leave some live adult trees. Pinyon juniper woodlands aren't thinned like a lot of other forest types are. It's still very, like, large chunks are cleared, but they do try to leave these tree islands. And then There's also an array of fuel reduction treatment methods that are commonly employed in these woodlands. So for example, one treatment method, which I'll be referring to as kind of the broadcast burn, where they cut down the trees and then burn the area during a cool period so it doesn't get out of control. The pile burn, where basically they cut down the trees, put all the kind of woody material into piles, and then burn those piles. So, you know, part of the soil is unburned and just these distinct piles are burned. And then another treatment method is mastication, where basically you have a machine that picks up the trees, chips the wood, and then those wood chips get spread out across the woodland floor. So I'll be discussing a study that we did in Utah, kind of right on the Colorado border, actually. And we looked at kind of these three different treatment methods. And also, one of our goals was to assess whether it's necessary to seed with native understory plant species to get the kind of understory vegetation cover that's desired. Basically, the area was done on this mesa top, and it was divided into these kind of eight different blocks that experienced these different types of treatments. And some of the blocks experienced seeding, and some were left unseeded. And then we also had, you know, a control, and then those three different treatments. And one thing that I want to kind of bring to your attention is the treatments were done in 2010. See that understory vegetation really declined. 2010 and kind of leading up to it was a really wet year. And so understory vegetation was really lush. And then the treatments occurred and they were followed by a drought. So you'll see that there's this big decline in the control, and that's due to weather that managers can't control. Some of the treatments had pretty large herbaceous cover responses. And what we really found was that seeding really strongly increased the herbaceous response. So these areas were likely seed limited in terms of getting that understory vegetation cover that's desired. And the other kind of big finding is that both kind of mastication and broadcast burning seem to really produce the large understory vegetation response that was desired. The main thing I want to point out is how high the invasive species cover was in that broadcast burn. And this was really predominantly due to invasive annual forbs. We didn't see a big cheatgrass response, which was really great. But one thing that I wanted to mention is that actually in kind of another study site where they went back 6 years after treatment, so kind of longer term study, they actually found that cheatgrass invasion, even though it hadn't been pronounced 2 years after, was really high 6 years post-treatment in kind of the unseeded mastication treatment. So I'm bringing this up in the context of it's really important to do long-term monitoring, because sometimes you won't immediately get the kind of the long-term response, and invasive species can establish multiple years after treatments. And then these treatments also really strongly influence wildlife, and with some species that are, you know, really dependent upon pinyon juniper trees for habitat and forage declining, but then other species responding positively. So it has really mixed responses in terms of wildlife. There was one kind of recent paper that came out that really found that over the short term, these treatments are having kind of negative or neutral, but not positive effects on birds and small mammals. But that might be because it takes time for the shrubs to come back, which wildlife species can depend on. But what is really clear is that, you know, there's kind of losers and winners with these types of treatments that are going on in these pinyon juniper woodlands.
You're listening to Valley Voices and highlights from Dr. Miranda Redmond's presentation on pinyon pine and juniper habitat from a recent naturalist night in Carbondale.
So now I want to kind of totally switch gears and talk about some climate change impacts that have been happening in pinyon juniper woodlands that haven't really been pronounced here in this part of the state, but has been pronounced in a lot of the southwestern U.S., including just in kind of the Mesa Verde National Park area, as well as in northern Arizona and New Mexico. And so kind of across globally, we're seeing a lot of tree mortality due to what's called hotter droughts. So basically these years of low precipitation that also have warmer temperatures that make the water that is available in the soil evaporate more, make the trees transpire more, and really just increase tree water stress. And so these hotter droughts have led to kind of global trends in tree mortality. And pinyon pine had really high levels of mortality in the early 2000s due to a multi-year hotter drought. I don't know if you all remember that time period, but it was dry and hot. Again, kind of that southwestern Colorado was really heavily hit. Portions of New Mexico was also really heavily hit, as well as Arizona. Utah seemed pretty unscathed. And just to kind of bring home the point, one of my first projects in Pinyon Juniper Woodlands, I wanted to look at, okay, you know, I've read about all this mortality. I'm really interested in, are these woodlands going to come back? Are these trees going to make it again? So I had what I felt like this robust sampling design where I was going to sample these kind of low mortality and high mortality areas. So I drove down to southwestern Colorado and drove a lot longer than I thought because it was so hard to find low mortality areas. Yeah, one of my graduate students this past summer was doing field work in kind of Colorado and New Mexico, and he just needed to find kind of 8 adult pinyon trees for his sites and had the hardest time in New Mexico because that's how severe that mortality was. It's really different in kind of that part of the world. And a study that was done in New Mexico recently found that this tree mortality actually then further exacerbates water stress because when the leaves fall from the tree, there's a lot more solar radiation coming down, which is increasing evaporation rates. This was done in just one area that's dominated by monsoonal precipitation, so the effects are probably a lot more pronounced, but it does really highlight how these mortality events might really reduce the resilience of these woodlands to kind of further climate warming and projected increases in drought. A really central question to a lot of my research is, you know, should we be concerned about declines in pinyon and or juniper populations, although I mostly focus on pinyon, given predicted increases in temperatures and recent mortality events? And where on the landscape should we be concerned? And what are the bottlenecks to getting those trees to regenerate after that mortality? So in other words, these landscapes that have undergone really dramatic change, what are they going to become in the future? It's important to remember that there's kind of multiple different steps that are required in order to get kind of a reproductively mature, healthy pinyon juniper woodland. So first, you know, you need sufficient seed availability. And if you have sufficient seeds, those seeds must be able to, you know, germinate and establish to have these juveniles on the landscape. And those, you know, through continued growth and survival, do you have those kind of mature pinyon pines that hopefully are then reproducing seeds? And so I'm first going to talk about some work that I did looking at kind of seed production and how it's changed from kind of the 1970s to today. And this is a project that I did actually as a graduate student in collaboration with my PhD advisor, Nicole Barger, and someone who now works for the USDA ARS, Frank Forsella, and doesn't work in pinyon juniper woodlands anymore, but did his dissertation work in the 70s on pinyon pine cone production. And so I basically went out to these sites and resampled them to see how they changed from when he did his study to today. Yeah, this is actually my first project in graduate school. Got in the car, drove to these sites all across New Mexico and kind of the very northwestern part of Oklahoma, and recruited my mom to help me collect some pine branches to measure for cone production. And used this really neat methodology that Frank Forsella had used. Basically, we're able to reconstruct comb production going back about 15 years by because trees on tree branches, they kind of leave the history right there for you to look at. And so an annual whorl, basically it's marking a new year. And then these branches also leave behind these cone scars. So you can go back and it does a really phenomenal job at reconstructing past comb production. And so I was able to reconstruct past comb production from 2003 to 2012, and Frank Forsella had reconstructed it from 1969 to 1978. So we had kind of these two different decades to really compare how comb production has changed. I just want to point out that when Frank Forsella had sampled, which I'm referring to as the 1974 decade, it was a lot cooler than when I sampled, so in the 2008 decade. So you can see that temperatures really increased a lot from when he sampled to when I sampled. Just as a caveat, if I showed you a longer temperature graph, it wouldn't be nearly as pronounced. So don't be totally alarmed. But I'm just showing you this because in terms of my sampling, it was really cool when he sampled and really hot when I sampled. And if we look at how comb production's changed during these two time periods, we found that, you know, on average across these sites, there's about a 40% decline in comb production. But one thing that I want to point out is that this decline in comb production is among live trees only. So there's been a lot of mortality, and so that would be even greater declines. But this is just among live trees because we were really interested of the trees that are present, how has comb production changed? This really, you know, suggests that climate and projected continued increases in temperature will likely continue to negatively impact pinyon cone production. And kind of to further support this, when we look at, okay, well, what years did they produce those really high seed crops? Because pinyon is a masting species, meaning pretty much all the trees in a stand will produce seeds all at once, 1 year, and then not for many years. And so what we found is those years when they had those really high cone crops, late summer temperatures, which is actually the time when cones are initiated, were generally cool. So they're producing those cone crops during, you know, cool late summer temperatures, and they're not having many cone crops during warm late summer temperatures. So this, you know, really suggests that temperatures might negatively impact seed cone production. Seed production might be a bottleneck to pinyon regeneration in the future. And this also has really important implications for wildlife species. So pinyon jay, for example, has been declining over the past 40 years, and this may partially explain those declines.
You've been listening to Valley Voices and highlights from Dr. Miranda Redmond's recent Naturalist Night presentation in Carbondale. You can find the entire talk and all Naturalist Night talks at grassrootstv.org. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening.